The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
The Nicole Sandler Show. Questioning authority daily. And that could be the very reason why YouTube is upset. Hey, YouTube. The music bed you hear beneath my voice is from a broadcast sound library that I pay for and have the receipts. So I've got your copyright violation right here. And now, here's Nicole.
Well, the good news is it's Friday, so we've got that going for us. If you thought I was in a bad mood yesterday, just wait for today. Let's start with something funny. Our pal Lauren Mayer got going early this week. She does a new comedy song each week, but they usually come out Fridays after my show is complete, so I wind up running them sometime the following week. But today she surprised me. She had the new song ready to go before I hit the air. So thank you, Lauren Mayer, and take it away.
Trump gave a speech none of us wanted to go see. Disgusting us, cause the lies weren't hard to find. So you gotta give a hand to Miss Pelosi. She knew how to tell us all what's on her mind. She let it rip, let it fly. Now all the Republicans complain and whine and cry, she ain't backing down, but she'll tell you why. Cause if Trump keeps telling lies, she'll tear them down to size and let it rip, let it fly. Why the tantrums? You don't have to show off your indignation. As if Trump doesn't insult opponents, athletes, immigrants, or girls. There ain't no logic to your hypocritical vociferation. Turns out you're the triggered snowflakes, gasping and clutching your pearls. She let it rip, she's so fly. Trump refused to shake her hand, he's such a classy guy, but she didn't walk out or holler, you lie. So don't whine about respect of norms your party wrecked. Let it rip, let it fly. Trump ain't fun of the disabled, he's been caught philandering. Shreds the Constitution, says it means that he's a king. Steals from veterans' charities, you never said a thing. So now why all the drama, cause a smart Italian grandma let it rip, let it fly. Along with every witness you said couldn't testify, sure it was a stunt, also the perfect reply. After all of Trump's offenses, that's what makes you lose your senses. Let it rip, let it fly. Cause if Trump keeps telling lies, she'll cut him down to size and let it rip, let it fly.
Oh my goodness, I kept cutting Lauren off before she was done. Before the big finish, Lauren Mayer, everyone. Find her at Lauren's Comedy. Find her on YouTube, on Facebook, all over the place. If you heard our show, we did a whole segment with Lauren Mayer during the holidays where we played a whole bunch of her songs, and you see just how talented she is. Again, she does basically a song every week. That takes creativity and talent. So thank you, Lauren Mayer. So if you're wondering why I'm in a lousy mood today, well, it's a continuation of yesterday. I see this country just going down the shitter. Donald Trump, how the fuck did we ever elect him president? I just don't get it. I had a great guest, I thought, booked for today. But probably my fault. I had it in here. I never got back to follow up and reconfirm it when I realized I didn't have a phone number for the guest. I emailed him like, are we still on for today? Oh, no, I'm so sorry. I should have gotten back to you and let you know that we couldn't fit it in for today. Really? This is a publicist. It would be one thing if I'm talking to the person, an author, and they, you know, but this is a publicist who gets paid to do this shit. So I actually have a couple of interviews in the can, as they say. It was from over the holidays when Howie Klein was on vacation, and he hooked me up with a few of the candidates that Blue America has endorsed. And I still have a couple that I didn't air. So we've got that ready to go if I need it. The phone lines are open. 954-889-6410 is the number. You can Skype in to Nicole Sandler. Couple of things to tell you about. Yeah, Mr. Hassan. I was supposed to have Rick Hassan on. And if you don't know him, you should check out his Twitter feed. He's great on, he's an election issues lawyer. So this is what he deals with, is election law. And I really wanted to talk to him about what the fuck happened in Iowa, because it's a travesty. So he'll be on in a few weeks. You know, he's got to do all the big shows first. I get it. I get it. I want to share with you, though, a piece that David Dayan just wrote over at the American Prospect, where he's now editor-in-chief. And the headline reads, Tom Perez should resign, preferably today. But I'll tell you what, I'm going to start today. We're going to do things a little backwards. We're going to start with an interview that I recorded when Howie, you know, over the holidays. And anyway, so the California primary is coming up Super Tuesday, March 3rd, and Liam O'Mara, oh, somebody's calling. I don't know that I should take a call right now. Well, let's try it. Hi, who's this? Hi,
this is Roger in Minneapolis.
Hey, Roger in Minneapolis. How are things there?
They're unseasonably warm. We've had an unusually warm winter here. But that makes things dangerously icy, and I can write a book about fun with falling down and getting concussions.
Yep, I hear you. but are you enjoying it anyway? Are you enjoying, even though it's gonna, you know, it's bringing about the end of the planet? Are you enjoying the warm weather on February 7th?
Well, I have to say that. Global warming has been clearly noticeable here since the early 90s, very clearly noticeable. And it has made living in Minnesota overall a bit easier, I must say. But I have a certain sense of foreboding about it, no doubt. But what about fun living in newly fascist, enabling act as of the day before yesterday, yep, America?
And you wonder why I'm crying. I mean, this is it. This is, we are witnessing the end of the Republic because we couldn't keep it. We are witnessing the takeover of this country by a guy who is just the most horrific excuse for a human being. The man has no decency about him. There's nothing, there's not one redeeming quality I can say about Donald Trump. Can you come up with one good thing to say about the man?
Well, you know, I honestly, most definitely, cannot. And it's kind of a horrifying test to me, because I really believe in the intrinsic goodness of people and of the inherent possibility in us to learn to live cooperatively and share on the planet. And, you know, I was absolutely horrified when Ronald Reagan was elected. I could not. I mean, I was just beset.
You
with
and me
horror.
Both. That was my 21st birthday. He was elected on my 21st birthday. And, well, you know, my birthday is November 4th, so it would be nice if the world, if the country gave me a nice birthday gift and voted Trump out of office. Somehow with each passing day, I see that as less and less likely.
Well, I had the experience of having repeated dreams back in the early 80s after Reagan became president. And as heartless as so many things he was doing was, and I was getting also recurring dreams of nuclear war and all kinds of awful stuff, I had a series of repetitive dreams in which I met Ronald Reagan in my dream. And he started crying and talking about his childhood and how he had felt unloved by his mother and stuff. And I realized inside of my heart, reflecting on the meaning of that dream, was that underneath the absolute horror was a very injured person in Ronald Reagan.
Yeah,
I'm afraid I don't see anything like that in Trump. He is something else. And the question that let's not forget, he's just the head of the snake or the rattler of the snake. And he represents an inherent systemic problem that we have with people being willing to be xenophobic and attempt to blame and lay off their ills on others.
Yeah.
And we've seen demagogues push things very far in the past. Trump just had his enabling act in the form of this so-called acquittal. And I am not sure how far this country is going to allow this guy to go. At this point, it looks like maybe all stops are on. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. I just know we're not in a good place. And if we, by we, I mean you and me and everybody listening and anybody with a conscience in this country, if we don't step up to turn things around here, to get that criminal con man out of office, to make sure we elect a decent human being, then we're lost. Then this experiment is over. We have no future. We have no fucking future.
Well, here is a very strange stop that has occurred to me. As vehemently as I was opposed to seeing Romney become elected president in 2012, as vehemently as I opposed that, and his talking about the 47% that were just takers to his little private club, and, you know, Rafalka and carrying his car, the guy has got major issues. Check this out. Here's an idea. Now, I sincerely think that we are poised to see if we can keep the Republic alive. I think that we will have a President Sanders and possibly a Vice President Warren.
That would be ideal.
In the near future. But what about this? What if Romney decided to run against Trump?
Please.
He should announce it today.
He should announce his challenge today. I don't know what he's waiting for. Joe Walsh.
He would have a landslide on his hands.
I think so, too. Joe Walsh, by the way, who is not a character that I could have ever supported, because we know what Joe Walsh is. I'm glad he became a never-Trumper, but he's still Joe Walsh. He dropped out. He ended his presidential bid today. Not that it was ever anything but a publicity stunt for him, but Mitt Romney could actually do something here.
I think that Romney shows signs of being able to learn. And some of these right-wingers are able to learn. And right now, we need to get this orange menace off our necks. And I think we need to start a movement to beg Romney to run.
Well, you know what? No, that's where we part company. Because, look, I'm in the business of trying to get Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren elected. The Republicans should be screaming. All those goddamn never-Trumpers that insist on invading my television set, invading the so-called, you know, Democratic answer to Fox, which it isn't, but they've taken over MSNBC, so it is now the never-Trumper channel. Let them do it. They should. It's their party. Let them get a reasonable person, probably the only one left holding elected office on the Republican side. They should be the ones telling him to get in the race and run. We need to worry about getting Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren elected, preferably both.
I absolutely agree with that. But let's put the call out to our Republican potential semi-allies to please draft Romney.
Yeah.
I think it would make it more difficult for Sanders to win the presidency if he won the nomination and Romney became the nominee. But at least it would solve our greatest menace.
I would take anyone over Trump. I would take my dog Jackson as president over Trump because I know Jackson would make better decisions. Just saying.
Well, the part of the challenge we face is maintaining our own individual coherence in the face of this baffling, draining experience that we're experiencing here. And humankind has seen a problem similar to this in the past, in the 1930s in Germany, and it obviously didn't respond very well. Are we as meek and as cowed?
Yes.
By our
sense. Obviously, look at what we've let Donald Trump get away with. Obviously, we don't have anybody strong enough on the Democratic side to stand up to his bullshit, and we're not. Why the fuck aren't we in the streets? You know what? I'm going to let you go. I'm going to play. I'm not going to read today's What's News. I'm going to play for you the extended version, because I'll tell you, it took me hours. Say thank you for calling, Roger, and I really appreciate it because I needed someone to talk to today. But when I recorded What's News this morning, it took me longer than usual, mostly because there was so much that I needed to kind of piece together like a puzzle. And there's so much going on, and it's so fucking depressing. But that said, I did put it together for you. And yeah, it does all come together. And if you've never listened to a What's News segment, I ask you to please listen today. It's also one of the things that has me so upset, because I'm realizing the enormity of the situation we're in. And it is urgent. We are past the point of urgency. We are at such a make or break time in our history, where if we don't step up and do the right thing and fix things and get this dictator, this megalomaniac, this mental midget — I know midget's not politically correct, but it's the only way I can describe him right now — if we don't do something to get him out of office, to get the Republican Party of today shaken loose from this weird mind control that he's got over them, we're fucked forever. I mean, we really are. This country, Donald Trump is trolling us by posting a video. He posted a video after the acquittal that shows him running for office, you know, Trump 2028, 2032, 2048. I mean, well into the future. He knows it gets us crazy. And so that's why he does it even more. If by some chance he happened across this video and saw me crying, he'd laugh his ass off because he thinks it's hysterical. This is what he wants. He wants people to be miserable. Let me change that. People who are not in his camp. Because did you know that in the United States of America, in the year 2020, apparently it is illegal to have thoughts against the president? If you are not a supporter of his, you're going to be drummed out of the party. You're going to be drummed out of government. Your head will be on a pike, and they'll scream bloody murder if you dare say that they said your head will be on a pike, but then they go ahead and put Mitt Romney's head on a fucking pike. So anyway, what do? We need to take to the streets. So if you, I implore you today, today's What's News segment runs just under 9 minutes. And, well, you'll see the puzzle fits together. Have a listen.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The results of the Iowa caucuses are now in at 100%, and the Associated Press still can't declare a winner. When most of the outstanding data came in on Thursday and it overwhelmingly benefited the Sanders campaign, the ineffective DNC chairman Tom Perez called for a complete re-canvassing of the caucus. Though the timing appeared problematic for many of Sanders' supporters, there were potential errors and inconsistencies spotted in at least dozens of the state's 1,711 precincts. What happens next? Your guess is as good as mine. In the wake of his acquittal by the Senate, Donald Trump is acting like an emboldened dictator. His first stop Wednesday was the National Prayer Breakfast, where he waved around copies of the Washington Post with the headline, "Acquitted." But he used the historically nonpartisan event to go hyperpartisan and completely mad.
I don't like people who use their faith as justification for doing what they know is wrong. Nor do I like people who say, "I pray for you," when they know that that's not so.
Of course, Trump was referencing both Mitt Romney, who invoked his religious beliefs when explaining his decision to vote for Trump's conviction and removal.
The allegations made in the articles of impeachment are very serious. As a senator juror, I swore an oath before God to exercise impartial justice. I am profoundly religious. My faith is at the heart of who I am. I take an oath before God as enormously consequential. I knew from the outset that being tasked with judging the president, the leader of my own party, would be the most difficult decision I have ever faced. I was not wrong.
And he used the National Prayer Breakfast to insinuate that the Speaker of the House was lying when she said she prays for the president.
I tore up a manifesto of mistruths. It's very hard for us to get you to talk about the issues that we are working on, HR3, infrastructure and the rest. He misrepresented all of that. It was necessary to get the attention of the American people to say, this is not true, and this is how it affects you. And I don't need any lessons from anybody, especially the President of the United States, about dignity. Dignity. Is it okay to start saying 4 more years in the House of Representatives? It's just unheard of. Is it unheard of for the president to insult people there who don't share his view, as well as to misrepresent, present falsehoods? Some would use the word lie. I don't like to use the word lie about what he is saying. So, no, I think it was completely, entirely appropriate. And considering some of the other exuberances within me, the courteous thing to do.
Well, then it was on to the celebration, his word, in the East Room of the White House. Speaking from the same location where Barack Obama solemnly announced the death of Osama bin Laden, Trump methodically called out some of the courageous Americans who risked everything by coming forward to speak the truth about what they knew, including Lieutenant Colonel Alex Vindman, that National Security Council aide who testified during the House impeachment hearings. And late Thursday night, we learned that Vindman will soon be informed that he's being reassigned from the White House to a position at the Department of Defense, could happen as early as Friday. And if Trump's attacks on them at the prayer breakfast wasn't enough, he doubled down in front of an even friendlier audience in the White House East Room by calling Speaker Nancy Pelosi a, quote, horrible person, and derided Senator Mitt Romney as a flip-flopping Republican with no sign of principles, whose vote to convict Trump, according to Trump, was born not out of principle, but bitterness over his failed 2012 presidential bid. It should be noted that in 1999, after Bill Clinton was acquitted by the Senate on impeachment charges, he spoke for 10 minutes in the Rose Garden, where he apologized to the American people for what he'd put the nation through. There was no apology Thursday from Trump, who suggested the country should be grateful he was willing to thwart what he called tremendous corruption, evil, dirty cops. That was a reference to James Comey, and dirty politics, which he blamed on Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, and Democratic investigators. And if you think it's going to be business as usual, you're probably wrong. It's now Trump's Republican Party, where his Treasury Department, under the leadership of his guy, Steve Mnuchin, who has continuously refused to hand over any of Donald Trump's tax returns, has already given congressional Republicans sensitive financial information related to Hunter Biden. And that's not even the worst of it. The Department of Justice, led by Attorney General Bill Barr, you know, Donald Trump's own personal Roy Cohn, announced a new policy on Wednesday regarding politically sensitive investigations. The Reader's Digest version of the new policy announced, by the way, in a memo that the FBI and all other divisions under the department's purview must first get Bill Barr's approval before investigating any of the 2020 presidential candidates. Nothing to be concerned about there, right? 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 Oh, and one more bit of breaking news as we go to press. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit Friday morning unanimously dismissed a lawsuit filed by more than 200 Democrats in Congress seeking to enforce the Constitution's anti-corruption emoluments provision. According to the unsigned order from the judges, quote, the members can and likely will continue to use their weighty voices to make their case to the American people, their colleagues in Congress, and the president himself, all of whom are free to engage that argument as they see fit. But we will not, indeed, we cannot participate in this debate. What? See, the 12-page opinion points to past Supreme Court decisions, which the judges said do not permit individual lawmakers to bring lawsuits on behalf of the entire body, in part because Congress acts through majority votes in the House and Senate. So, this dismissal comes on the heels of a new Washington Post report that details the massive rates charged by Trump's various properties for Secret Service lodging. For instance, billing taxpayers at rates as high as $650 a night at Mar-a-Lago dozens of times in 2017, and at a lower rate of $396 dozens of more times in 2018. And at the Trump National Golf Club in Bedminster, the Secret Service was charged $17,000 a month, to use a three-bedroom cottage on the property. Yes, that is an unusually high rent for homes in that area, according to receipts from 2017. And Trump's company billed the government even for days when Trump wasn't there. But Congress lacks standing to bring an emoluments case to court. And Bill Barr has to personally sign off on any investigations of any of the 2020 presidential candidates. This all leads me to ask, when do we take to the streets? Seriously. When do we stand up and stop the madness? I got the news. And that's it for What's News for today. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. It's what keeps me going and allows me to do this work. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com. And when you're there, please click on that donate button. So that was today's What's News. You see why I'm a little crazy today? Yeah, it took me hours to get that out. But look at all the shit that's coming together. And Donald Trump continues to gaslight America. So we do need to take to the streets. But you know what? When the groups that lead the protests from the Women's March to Move On, who put together these little pop-up protests, you know, I go down to the ones here. I live in South Florida. The protests they have down here are all at the federal building in Fort Lauderdale where we're permitted and you're allowed to protest there. So it's on a corner of Broward Boulevard and, I don't know, downtown Fort Lauderdale. And, you know, depending on the issue and the day and how much lead time there is, it pulls in, 70 to 200 people in South Florida. in Broward County, one of the bluest counties in the country, certainly the bluest in the state. And they can't break, really, 200. That's, if they got 200 people out there, that's a lot. People down here are apathetic. I always put it off to, well, that's Florida, it's apathy. But it's everywhere. We should, look, I look at other countries. Look at what went on in Hong Kong for months and months and months. Thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in the streets. If we can't even get our shit together to do that, to come out and protest this madman, this guy who's suffering from dementia, who I fully expect to have a massive coronary one day when he's in the middle of one of his Nuremberg rallies. If we can't get together to protest one of the most heinous excuses for a human being ever to emanate from this land, who now inexplicably became president of the United States, and we wonder why I'm losing my mind. France is still protesting, you're right. Other countries can do it. Why don't we? Now, I could go out on the street here in Coral Springs, where this is a suburb of Fort Lauderdale on the edge of the Everglades. People would just look at me like I'm crazy. Some might join me, but not enough to make, maybe it's because we're so spread out. You know where big protests happen? New York City. Because everything's concentrated in that small island. And you get many, many, many thousands of people out at once. We need to do that everywhere. Especially at the polls on November 3rd. This is it. This is our last chance to take back the country. This is our last chance to turn things around. This is our last chance to rid our government of these Republicans who would vote not guilty on Donald Trump after all this evidence and who would say no to somebody else who worked in the administration, who was in the room when it happened to testify. No, we don't need to hear from John Bolton. No. This is it. It's all hands on deck time. And if we can't get our shit together by November 3rd, I guess we deserve Donald Trump. Maybe we could all go out with one toast to Jim Jones and drink a Kool-Aid and say goodbye. Because honestly, if he wins re-election, I'm not sure that I have any other recourse. So let's elect great candidates. And that's what I'm going to do for the rest of the program today. I have a couple of interviews still in the can, as they say, and we are coming up on Super Tuesday on March 3rd. California is one of those states. And a couple of weeks ago, well, over the holidays, I got to speak with Liam O'Mara. Liam O'Mara is running for Congress from the 48th District of California. He'll tell you where that is and all that in the interview. If you're watching on YouTube, what you'll see is a picture of him on the screen. And yes, those are braids coming down from his beard. Really. What you don't see on the picture is the picture from the back where his hair is as long as those two braids coming off of his beard. I did ask him about it. We'll get to it. All right. So you know what? Let's not wait any longer. Let me introduce you to Liam O'Mara, candidate for Congress from California. All right.
Yeah, sounds good.
With us on the line now is Liam O'Mara. He's running for Congress from California's 42nd Congressional District. Liam, thank you so much for being with us today. We're meeting because of Howie Klein, who is a dear friend of mine, who is a regular on my program every Thursday, talking politics. And Howie, along with Digby and John Amato of Crooks and Liars, run the Blue America PAC. And my regular listeners know all about Blue America, but for those who are unfamiliar, it's a PAC unlike any other that I know of. And basically, they exist to identify and help raise money for real progressive candidates for Congress. And so Howie said to me, Nicole, you got to meet Liam O'Mara. And so thus our conversation. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure entirely. And I'm quite grateful that things like Blue America exist because of the difficulty of raising money for progressive candidates. You know, a lot of the establishment sources just have no interest whatsoever. So it's a lot harder to amplify our message and, you know, pick up attention.
Yeah, of course. First of all, tell us about the district. California's 42nd. You're east of Los Angeles?
Yes, in Southwest Riverside County. So just east of both Los Angeles and Orange County. So just over the mountains in Orange County. It's been represented for over 27 years now by Ken Calvert, who took the seat from a Democrat and has been holding it as the Republican for all that time.
Wow.
So it's kind of a ridiculous amount of time, realistically. I mean, 92 was my first actual election, and that's the year he won.
Wow.
It's historically written off as a conservative district and unwinnable by Democrats, which means that people tend not to invest in it. But it's one of only three remaining Republican seats in Southern California. And of the three remaining seats, it, demographically, it is the closest to flippable. And with the right messaging, I think that it already is flippable, because there's a lot of things that are generally ignored there if you can't raise the money or attention or really pick the right kind of strategy. So I spent a lot of time thinking about the district, doing research on, you know, what had been done before and what could be done differently before I decided to take a stab at this.
Right. And the district encompasses places like, if, and tell me if I'm mistaken, but like Temecula and like Elsinore, that area, right?
It does, yes. So it starts up in the north in East Vail, so East Vail, Norco, and Corona, and then runs down the 15 freeway all the way to the northern part of Temecula. There's only about somewhere between a quarter and a fifth of the city of Temecula is in the district, but the entire Temecula wine country is in the district.
Gotcha.
They decided to divide the city.
I spent a very long week in the hospital after I was at Murrieta Hot Springs, and I something got me that probably I had ingested before I ever got out there. So I don't want to cast aspersions on Murrieta Hot Springs. It was beautiful. But I wound up in the hospital with a really nasty infection for a week. This is back in the early 90s. But that's my memory of being in your district. So but they took very good care of me. So I will say that. So well, Liam O'Mara.
I'm glad they took care of you.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. It was a hell of an experience, though. Are there other Democrats running in the primary, or do you have competition?
There is one other. She jumped in a little later and is running as what she calls a pragmatic progressive, meaning she's a thoroughgoing centrist, defends the ACA, things like that. I mean, it's an unusual campaign in that she's not really invested in the grassroots and is focused much more on just tweeting. So there's not much I can say about it because there's not much happening there.
Right. Okay. But you're out in the community again. You got the endorsement of Blue America and thus our meeting here. So tell us a little bit about yourself. This is your first venture into politics. Yes, you're a historian.
I am a historian. Yeah, it's my first sustained venture into elective politics. Mm-hmm. I had put together a little committee to try and take a stab at this in 2018, but the other candidate that ran in 2018 managed to announce first, and I know the district has a hard time raising funds, so I bowed out then. This time around, I jumped in right away at the end of January, intent on trying to secure the nomination and stopping what happened last time. I am a historian. My main areas of focus are cultural history of the Middle East and Europe, and I focus a lot on, like, you know, globalization and the movement of ideas and transmission over time. So philosophies, religions, politics, economics. So I'm always my classes are heavily political, but I never really thought of myself as the standard bearer of a campaign, like the face of a campaign. So this is an unusual experience for me.
So what made you decide to run? Was there one thing, or was it just a buildup over time? What did it?
I guess I would call it a buildup over time. There's two key issues, two ways to answer that question. The first is, if someone says, why are you running? Well, it's the kind of things that, you know, your listeners would already be aware of, the slow decline of the middle class and rising poverty in this country, you know, declining living standards. I mean, there's a whole litany of things that infuriate me about our current political direction. to say nothing of the slow rise of the neo-fascism over the last few decades. But as far as actually being a candidate myself, the thing that pushed me over was looking at just how both the Trump and Sanders campaigns played out. Because in different ways, I think that they struck a chord because of a perception of authenticity. Mm. They seem to be just who they are. And they both ran as populists, you know, right and left populists.
Sure.
In Trump's case, a disingenuous one. But they both spoke to working class issues, and they both did not fit the typical scripted appearance of a politician. And I know, as an educator for the last dozen years, I mean, millennial and Gen Z students do tend to talk about authenticity as being very important, a sense of realness. They don't trust politicians. They have a kind of cynicism towards them. And unlike a lot of the Gen Xers who were similarly cynical about politics, they are politically engaged. They do care a lot about the political system. They just don't trust the politicians. So my idea is to kind of capitalize on that. Well, I am who I am. I'm not going to listen to focus groups about, you know, what I'm supposed to do. I'm mm-hmm. going to engage directly with people, talk to them, talk about the issues that are important. And if that's appealing, then it's an option for people.
Right. Okay. And in terms of authenticity, I guess I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up, and you address it on your website, LiamOmara.org. You don't look like your typical politician, certainly not your typical Washington politician. You've got rather long hair, you have braids, and you have a big beard, and that's braided as well.
Yeah, exactly. And there was a conscious decision in the process of putting together the campaign. Do I, you know, or should I at least trim the beard down to be shorter? I mean, I used to wear a shorter beard. I mean, I grew this out like 8 years ago or something like that. But, you know, I used to keep it fairly short. You know, I was never going to shave for politics, but I didn't have to keep the longer beard.
Right, right.
But the idea was it's been there for years. It's something that I quite like. And to take it off would seem sort of disingenuous. It would seem like I'm changing who I am for politics. And I don't see that people should have to do that. It doesn't make sense. I would rather be judged on the content of my character and my ideas than on my face.
Mm-hmm. Do you get questions?
And in the 21st century, we can get that.
Right. Do you get questions from potential constituents about it?
It's honestly very rare, and that has surprised me. I'm sure it comes up in people's thoughts more often than it comes up in their questions or statements, even amongst each other, because I have a lot of people that you know, describe discussions about it, things like this. It's only ever come up with the oldest voters, honestly.
Huh, interesting.
Younger voters have frequently cited it as an advantage to them because it does send a visual signal that I don't give a damn and that I am going to be who I am.
All right. Well, that works. Liam O'Mara is with us, LiamOmara.org. LiamOmara.org is the website. Lots of information on here, and I always appreciate it when candidates put their stances on issues on the website. You can always tell those who, maybe are ashamed of where they stand on certain issues because so many candidates do not have that kind of information on their websites. It's always a dead giveaway that this is probably someone you maybe can't trust, but you put it all out there. I hate this question, but I have to ask it anyway. What are the most important, because they're all important, but what are there any issues that stand out to you above the others that it's like, this is something I really want to tackle?
That question is one of the banes of my existence, honestly.
I hear you.
I do come at this as an academic, so a lot of things are rather important to me. First off, I want to comment on the issue of the website, since you brought it up. It does stand out to me that a lot of people do not bother to define a lot of their positions in advance, and I think much of that is so that they give themselves wiggle room. They can change their positions. They can change their ideas as they go along. And that honestly offends me a bit. It's one of the things that I'm trying to push back against. In terms of, you know, my presentation as a candidate, I'm going to lay out, these are my positions. I'm willing to discuss them. I'm willing to argue them and talk about them. But I'm not going to like change them based upon what a particular poll says. That's not really the point, because getting elected isn't the point. The point is having the ideas, wanting to change things.
Right.
So there's that. Okay, let's see. as far as top issues, where would you go from that? The key ones for me would all in some way or other tie into the economic foundation. So a simple shift toward, you know, what you can call tax fairness or a progressive taxation model. People tend to forget that that's actually what helped to build the middle class, because it creates an incentive for higher wages for workers. If you lower the taxes on the rich, then there's an incentive within the business to increase the compensation packages at the top. They get to choose to pay themselves. You know, if it's just going to go straight to Uncle Sam, why bother doing it? So they would pay lower salaries to themselves. It's not like they didn't get rich. We created a lot of millionaires in the 50s and 60s.
Yep.
But you're going from 25 to 50 times the average worker to 250 to 350 times the average worker, which is absolutely insane. And a lot of other policy areas could be addressed if you can address that one first. So a Green New Deal, investing heavily in the technologies that we're going to need in order to adapt to a changing world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, whether or not someone wants to argue, blah, 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 what caused it. I mean, I think the science is pretty clear on it, but people still want to fight over that. That's fine. Have that discussion. Not my business. I want to do something about it. And that does involve investing. And I think that, especially for my area, if you pitch it in terms of the way that it can create jobs and, you know, increase American innovation, I point to things like, you know, we used to be the leader in solar cell and battery technology. I mean, Jimmy Carter put solar cells on top of the White House and Reagan took them off. And now China is the world leader in both. And if you could tell them, like, look at the advantage we got out of the space race through investment. Medicare is another issue for me that comes up. It's a typical progressive issue, but in my district, I tend to focus on the arguments a little differently. I think one of the key factors in me deciding to run is an awareness of how framing works, of how you can message ideas differently. Progressives and liberals tend to talk about things like universal health care, Medicare, single payer, whatever, as a moral issue or a moral imperative. It makes no sense to leave so many people behind, sick and whatnot here, medical bankruptcies, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I point to, for people out here, I point simply to the fact that it'll put cash in your pocket. You know, whether or not, okay, think about the people who often object to it. Well, I get great coverage from my employer. I'm happy with my employer's health care package. I'm like, okay, great. Your employer's being overcharged. So if your employer no longer has to pay through the nose for your package, that money is already in your compensation, which means you get a raise.
Right.
Medicare for All would be the largest increase in salary for the middle class in a generation. It would be a massive pay rise.
Yes.
So if I tell people, you know, I could put $10,000 into your wallet, your money that you earn. And that's kind of powerful to a lot of conservatives because they hate taxes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I try to, like, you know, shift the ground on that a little bit. You're already being overtaxed. I'm trying to lower your burden and lower your cost of living.
Right. No, it makes sense. It's mind-blowing that people won't get that, or that they don't get it yet. And I think part of that is, you know, this disinformation campaign run by the right, where the nation's been gaslighted for so long on so many things that, you know, when you lay out facts, people don't believe facts. They believe stuff that, you know, comes out of the mouth of Donald Trump or out of Fox so-called news.
Right.
And it's a battle to say, wait a minute, facts are facts. You know, this is what you can trust, that you can't. And we're in this weird sort of post-truth era, it seems, right now. So it's hard to cut through when you lay out the facts that so many people won't take them as fact.
Yeah, and this is one of the things that terrifies me. I mean, the economics is enough of a reason for me to want to get involved in politics, but quite another, and one that I don't generally talk much about, is that one of my areas of academic expertise, one of the things that I've studied a lot, is the fascist movements, the nationalist movements, you know, the development of those things, and not just in the, you know, the 20s, 30s and whatnot, and certainly not in just the ones that everyone's heard of. Now, when people point to this. They're like, oh, Trump is Hitler. And I, no, I mean, he's, I mean, there were dozens of fascist leaders, and people always leave out Salazar. They leave out Metaxas. You don't talk about them. And we don't really acknowledge the fact that that approach to politics never went away. It has consistently evolved. It's appeared right. in dozens of regimes all around the world, in Africa and Latin America. It exists today in places like Turkey and Russia. And the steady infiltration of that kind of that approach to politics, that emotive approach that tells you not to think. Mm-hmm. I mean, fascism is anti-rational by its nature. It tries to build a sense of of collective belonging. You know, let's wear the same things, and let's go to the rallies, and let's cheer the leader, and let's listen to what the leader says and not really think about things. And that's actually really appealing to a lot of people on a psychological level, which makes it dangerous for a republic.
Right. Well, let me ask you this then. Liam O'Mara, again, is our guest. He's a candidate for the Democratic nomination for Congress from California's 42nd district. But you, as we discussed earlier, you are a historian, you're a college professor, so you teach this stuff. So given your knowledge of history, of world history, seeing Donald Trump and how he interacts with other authoritarian figures around the world, given his propensity for, it seems his need to cozy up to people like from Putin to Erdogan to Duterte, to Kim Jong-un. Mm-hmm. What does this tell you about him and the rallies he holds that I sort of flippantly refer to as Nuremberg rallies? Does this give you pause? Does it frighten you as it does me?
It honestly terrifies me, and you're right to make that kind of parallel. Except for the fact that when we think of Nuremberg, we're thinking of a particular archetypal event, and these mm-hmm. are just consistent. But fascist displays were consistent, and they had to be. I mean, think about his desire for a military parade.
Yeah.
We
yes.
used to mock the Soviet bloc for doing that. It's just not something that republics generally do.
Mm-hmm.
But the sense of symbolism there is powerfully appealing. I mean, he has all the markers of the authoritarian mindset. That was obvious from his business career. It's just who he is. And the appeal of authoritarian politics has always been here in the U.S. I mean, the potential of going fascist by the ballot box has always been there. But there's always been a number of checks within our civil society mm-hmm. And within the public sphere that helped to prevent that. And the erosion of the functioning public sphere and of our civic engagement with one another has really helped to foster this. And a lot of people will often point to things like the rise of Fox News and whatnot. There's no single answer. There's a lot of factors that played a part in that. But certainly that is definitely one of them.
Right. And the vilifying, the vilifying of the media, the vilifying of mm-hmm. anybody yeah. who holds a different political view than him. For instance, as a Democrat, I'm considered to be scum by Donald mm-hmm. Trump. It's not supposed to be that way. It's never been this way. I mean, Barack Obama, I've had plenty of problems with him, but I believed that he felt as if he was president for all the people. Donald Trump, on the other right. hand, feels like he only represents you if you're a Republican.
Right. And that has been building up for quite some time. And I think that people are only becoming aware of it once it's reached a kind of fever pitch under Trump. There are strong elements of this kind of cult of personality and vilification going back into the 1980s around the Reagan movement. But there was still more of an emphasis on a kind of positive message, even though it was at one time, on the one hand, trashing the opponents, it was still trying to point to a positive future for America. Trump is much more apocalyptic in his tone. And there's a significant shift in the way that they approach things that does make the other side into scum. I mean, one of the things I point out to my students is that no democracy, no republic can possibly survive without the concept of a loyal opposition.
Mm-hmm.
It is possible to disagree and still be loyal Americans. And that concept has actually already disappeared for a very large chunk of the U.S. population and a clear majority of Republicans. We can see that even in my incumbent. I mean, he has frequently over a period of many years now stated publicly that he's not interested in talking to anyone who hasn't voted to him. That
wow.
he feels he's won enough elections, and he just does not feel that he needs to care about the opinions of anybody who isn't already a supporter. And that's not how it's supposed to work. He's supposed to represent me as well.
Of course.
Yeah, that's dangerous. This is frightening. All the more reason we not only need to hold on to the House, but the Democrats need to take the Senate and the White House. Because, frankly, I fear that if Mitch McConnell is allowed to continue his assault on the judiciary, on our court systems, and Donald Trump can remain in office, that we're doomed. I think we're barely going to make it through 2020. I fear if they win another term in either controlling the House or the executive branch, that we're done. Am I being too pessimistic?
It's hard to say. I like to point to the fact that Trump himself does seem relatively incompetent in some ways. He's too transparent, which means we can see a lot of the mistakes he's making.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be harder for him to actually carry out that kind of transition into what we tend to call a managed democracy, something more like Russia, where you have the pretense of elections, but it's really much more of a mm-hmm. personal dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that he has consistently gotten away with so much, and that his base is more loyal to him than to any other modern president, is honestly frightening. So it is entirely possible, but it is hard to say. One thing that I'd point to is it's dangerous to think just in terms of our need to take the White House, take the Senate, that sort of thing. Yes, that's all true, but we have to take it with the right people and with the right approach, because if we do not tackle the core systemic issues that made Trump viable, all we do is we set ourselves up for something worse.
Right.
And this is why, I mean, Trump is worse than W. was worse than Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
Each one sets out to destroy government more and to concentrate more and more power in the hands of the executive. It's been a steady progression there. And throughout that whole period, Democrats have tended to, well, particularly on the larger national stage, run as Republican light and not change a great deal. I mean, Obama and Clinton are basically Eisenhower Republicans at best in terms
mm-hmm.
of their policy approaches.
Yeah, I agree.
In terms of their handle on the economics. And if we don't really deal with it, I mean, Trump won because he can latch onto the anger people have. They don't know what they're angry about, per se. They don't know the real details of this, because most people don't really understand policy. But they know they're upset. They know things don't seem right. And if someone comes along and says, I can give you the answer, this is the answer, I have it, vote for me, that'll work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, I mean, just taking the White House, if we take the White House with, you know, just some smiling empty suit, then that person's going to lose the next election to somebody worse than Trump.
Right. And then we have another repeat of 2020, where the Democrats then lose, you know, all this, you know, a massive routing in the House. And I don't even want to think about that. I prefer to think of the positive. So one last question for you. Liam O'Mara, again, is our guest running for Congress from the 42nd District of California. Who in Congress or in politics and government do you admire? Are there any that you say, that's what I aspire to be, that's what I want to do, they're a good example?
Well, in terms of character and principle, absolutely. I have long admired Sanders for taking what mm-hmm. appear to be unpopular positions and sticking to his guns, and
yep.
over time making them popular, or at least being right before anyone else was. The fact that he was for marriage equality in the 70s is remarkable. He has consistently been right over and over again on a lot of major issues.
Mm-hmm.
And I admire that he stuck with that. And I admire a lot of the freshmen that came in. I mean, people like AOC are a breath of fresh air,
yep.
and willing to talk about issues that people have tended to neglect. In terms of, you know, who I would kind of pattern myself after, I'm a bit more of an egghead than people like. I mean, Bernie's much better at crowds than I am, that's for sure. But in terms of his character and his principles, I have a great deal of, I think, well, I would like to say that I would hope to say that I have something in common with him, at least in sticking with my positions and basing them on reason, as opposed to just whatever feels good and whatever fits a particular popular notion.
Great. I'm with you 100% on that. Couldn't agree more. Liam O'Mara, again, the website is liamomara.org. You're on Facebook and Twitter. It's Liam O'Mara, Roman numeral 4, IV.
You're typing it in Facebook. You can just type in Liam O'Mara for Congress and it goes straight to me.
Oh, cool.
Liam O'Mara for Congress is my Twitter. It's my Facebook. It's my Instagram. They all just say Liam O'Mara for Congress.
All right, Liam, it was a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much. Best of luck. And when is the California primary?
My pleasure, and thank you very much. The primary is 3rd March, and then the general is 3rd November. But 3rd March, we need your help and support in the coming 2 months.
You got it. Thank you so much, Liam. It was great talking with you. It's so nice to meet you.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
So, Liam O'Mara, a candidate for Congress
that
from California.
Thank you.
Oh, 48th. I guess I didn't edit that. Anyway, so I'm glad we aired that today. Because you needed to hear from him. Liam O'Mara, great candidate. So we did talk about, during the interview, his beard and his hair. And interestingly enough, about a week or so after we recorded that, he sent me an email telling me that the issue of the hair has come up. And let me give you the latest. He said they're actually going to incorporate his hair into a fundraiser. So they're calling it a fundraiser instead of a fundraiser. Get it? Fundraiser. It's set for February 16th from 3 to 6 p.m. He writes it will probably be live streamed, but video is definitely being made of the whole event, music, comedy, shearing, and will be posted on YouTube, Facebook, etc. afterward. If you can mention it, that would be fantastic. So we just did. So there you go. It is a fundraiser where I don't know how much of the hair and the beard he's going to cut off, but he's going to do something and he's going to do it as a fundraiser for his campaign. So that happened. While that interview was playing, more news was made. And I'm actually going to read it to you from the source because I don't want to get anything wrong here, but I told you this was going to happen. Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman was escorted out of the White House today, where he has dutifully served his country and his president. He does so having spoken publicly once and only pursuant to a subpoena from the United States Congress. His lawyer issued a statement. Let me see if I can get the statement up. It says, today, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman was escorted out of the White House where he has dutifully served his country, what I just said. There's no question in the mind of any American why this man's job is over, why this country now has one less soldier serving it at the White House. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman was asked to leave for telling the truth. His honor, his commitment to right, frightened the powerful. During his decades of service to this country, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman has served quietly but dutifully, and he has served with honor. He came into the public eye only when subpoenaed to testify before Congress, and he did what the law demanded. In recent months, many entrusted with power in our political system have cowered out of fear, and yet a handful of men and women, not endowed with prestige or power, but equipped only with a sense of right born out of years of quiet service to their country, made different choices. They courageously chose to honor their duty with integrity, to trust the truth, and to put their faith in country ahead of fear. And they have paid a price. The truth has cost Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman his job, his career, and his privacy. He did what any member of our military is charged with doing every day. He followed orders, he obeyed his oath, and he served his country even when doing so was fraught with danger and personal peril. And for that, the most powerful man in the world, buoyed by the silent, the pliable, and the complicit, has decided today to exact revenge. Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman leaves the White House today, but we must not accept the departure of truth, duty, and loyalty that he represents. In this country, right matters, and so does truth. Truth is not partisan. If we allow truthful voices to be silenced, if we ignore their warnings, eventually there will be no one left to warn us.
Again, that's a statement released by Alexander Vindman's attorney following Vindman's being escorted from the White House property, telling him his services are no longer needed. This is life under post-impeachment Trump. And again, keep in mind, he's been impeached. Yeah, I know it's late. We ran late too long today because there's one other thing I would need to share with you. And it's a piece that just went up from David Dayan at the American Prospect, which is a must-read magazine now that David Dayan is executive editor there. It's a short one, but I'm going to share this with you before we leave. In fact, you know what? It's that short that I can probably start the ending music underneath. So let's get Lily Hayden playing. Yes, for those who ask, this is Lily Hayden, L-I-L-I-H-A-Y-D-N, and she makes incredible music. So this is one of hers that she gave to me to use for a theme song on the show. All right, so the article I want to share with you from the American Prospect at prospect.org. And the headline reads, Tom Perez should resign, preferably today. And the article reads this way. Tom Perez should never have been DNC chair. He was used as part of a proxy war between Barack Obama's faction of the establishment and the rest of the party, which was already fully ready to move on after the 2016 mess. Both Harry Reid and Chuck Schumer had embraced Keith Ellison, one of Bernie Sanders' top surrogates in 2016 for the position, a show of unity that might have helped rebuild broken bonds within the party. Just as Howard Dean's elevation to DNC chair in 2005 brought insurgents within a broader circle of power, Ellison's victory would have at least attempted a rough union between the Sanders and Clinton forces, and given the party's left wing more of a shot at creating a strong and legitimate message to counter Donald Trump. Obama couldn't handle it. He pressured Perez, who was musing about running for governor in Maryland, into the race and bore down on the establishment to break with the Ellison unity shtick and accept his preferred candidate. This eventually succeeded with the help of a party coup in Puerto Rico that delivered Perez all of that delegation's votes. Oh, so that's what happened. Okay, but wait, there's more. Obama, now a movie studio boss, and occasional public speaker, had no personal reason to force Perez on the party. The most logical reading of his rationale would be that he did it for the blob. The blob, the network of consultants, strategists, pollsters, lobbyists, policy mandarins, and media figures for whom politics is their business. They didn't want the spigot to close on the hundreds of millions of dollars that flow through campaigns. And they needed to eliminate the threat of a gatekeeper like Ellison, who might have different ideas. So Perez was installed. The disastrous past week of Democratic politics is the result, deeply damaging to the perceived competence of a party that is attempting to ask the American people to put them back in power to engage in activist government. The Iowa results weren't just one snafu, but part of a pattern of self-dealing and stupidity within a party elite that's more concerned with staying in power than taking power. And so, for the second straight cycle, like Debbie Wasserman Schultz, a DNC chair needs to step down before the end of their term. Tom Perez must go. And to that, we say, you're right on, David Dayan. Yeah. Find, again, David Dayan at the American Prospect at prospect.org. So I wanted to make sure I could share that with you before the program ended today. See, the things I predicted at the beginning of the show are already happening. Vindman is gone. Trump is just you know, reeling in all of his dictatorial powers. And make no mistake, it's going to get worse, a lot worse, before it gets better. So don't forget. Tonight, the next Democratic debate. They vote in New Hampshire on Tuesday. Debate tonight, New Hampshire Tuesday. We need to stay engaged. And most of all, we need to make sure you're registered and vote. Because once again, I'll say it, keep your eye on the prize. And the prize is a White House without Donald Trump in it. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'll see you Tuesday.